very pleased to have Abby Stewart here. She got her PhD from Harvard, was then a professor at Boston University before moving to University of Michigan, where she's now the Sandra Schwartz Tungri Distinguished University Professor of Psychology and Women's Studies. She's won various awards, including the Henry Murray Award, the Carolyn Wood Sharif Award, and the Eleanor Roosevelt Fund Award. Today, she's going to tell us about creating an inclusive climate.
Thank you. Thanks very much. I'm delighted to be here, and this is my second visit to Perimeter, which is, as you all know, a very special place, and so it's a pleasure to be here. I'm going to talk about the things we've been doing at the University of Michigan since 2001 to try to create a more inclusive climate for faculty. And in saying that, I want to acknowledge that whenever you make the climate better for one constituency, faculty, graduate students, postdocs, undergraduates, staff, you make it better for all constituents, but not as much better. And so there are efforts to do those things for all constituencies. And I will, if there's time, talk about some of the things we do for other constituents besides faculty. But this is my primary focus. So I want to acknowledge at the front end that in any effort to create an inclusive climate, context that you're working in and history matter. That's obvious. But I want to say we have some specific things at Michigan that are part of our reality. We are recognized, known for having made pretty kind of prominent, visible efforts on diversity for a very long time. So this effort I'm going to describe kind of fits into a timeline that starts at least in 1988 when President Duderstadt announced the Michigan mandate as a blueprint for racial ethnic diversity at all levels. He also created faculty diversity goals at that time. In 93, he announced a kind of parallel program for gender, and that is certainly something we explicitly build on in the initiative, that I'm going to talk about. In 2001, there was a famous meeting of what has become known as, well, famous in the States, in a limited circle, what has become known as the MIT Nine, a group of nine individual presidents who were presidents of institutions who Chuck Vest, who was the president of MIT, was close to. So Michigan was one of them. He'd been our provost, and he invited these eight peers to come to a meeting at MIT with three senior women scientists to talk about the issue of women in science. And he deliberately set it up to be a 3-to-1 ratio of women to men. All the presidents at that time were men. And he deliberately was trying to create a conversation in which the women could actually tell these presidents things that would be helpful to do. That meeting resulted in two concrete outcomes. One is a New York Times article that said, there really is a problem of women in science and engineering. We know that because these nine presidents say so. That was on the front page of the New York Times. And this group has continued to meet to discuss kind of common ideas about how to move forward on these issues. In 2003, you may know, the university brought an affirmative action cases to the Supreme Court. It won one case and lost the other, so we call it a win. However, in 2006, Proposal 2 was passed, which constrained the use of affirmative action in hiring. So we operate, I say all these things to say, we operate in a very particular context. A lot of our remedies are designed to deal with that context. So I'm here partly to try to give you ideas of things you might be interested in doing at Perimeter, but you have a very different context and a very different history. So I acknowledge that, and I'm just saying, I don't think I can give you answers. I can hopefully offer you examples of what we've been doing, and you can think about what the right answer would be for Perimeter. So, the program I'm going to describe started in 2001 when the National Science Foundation, coincident with the MIT 9 meeting, these were completely separate paths that happened to happen at the same time, announced a new program of institutional transformation grants. This is a pretty unusual thing for a funding agency to do, to say, okay, we'd like to fundamentally change the way science is done.
But that's what they said. They said that they wanted us to experiment, the institutions, to try to figure out how to improve the situation for tenured and tenure-track women faculty in science and engineering. So why that focus? They identified recruitment, retention, and promotion, visibility, and authority or leadership as key issues. The reason they said that was that after 30 years of pipeline programs that had made a major difference in the presence of girls and women in K-12 science and engineering programs and in college majoring and in graduate school, there had been, in effect, no change at all in 30 years at the faculty level. So the numbers were absolutely flat. So you've got the pipeline fuller and no difference at the top. So their analysis of the situation was that they needed to try a program that attacked the problem at the top, not the bottom, and that that might work faster, but also that they would continue to work on the pipeline so that there'd be bottom-up and top-down strategies. The focus of ADVANCE was to fix the institution, not the women. So the pipeline programs really start from the assumption that the problem is something we need to do to make women more interested in science and engineering. This program starts from the assumption that that's not really the problem. The problem is what happens when women get there. So we need to look at everyday practices and policies and try to figure out how the institution's making the environment unreceptive to women wanting to be there or stay there. So we developed a bunch of programs focusing on recruitment and hiring, retention, specifically focusing on the nature of faculty interactions or climate, what happened in the course of evaluations, and leadership development. And these are just pictures of our launch. The head of the NSF program, Alice Hogan, is there. The president of the university is on the other side of me. And as you can see, a lot of people are there. A lot of faculty showed up for this. This had a lot of institutional support and buy-in from the top. So what did we do about recruitment? And I want to stress, this was an experiment. We didn't know this would help. It did, and maybe something else would have helped more, but this is what we did, and it did help. We created a committee of senior faculty. We used what we know in social science about how messages are received. They're received well when they come from a credible source. We knew that if we had science faculty delivering a message to scientists, that was going to matter more than if we had social scientists telling scientists things. So we worked on developing a cadre of senior scientists who knew the literature and felt expert about how to do effective hiring. So they developed knowledge and advice about search practices. They actually operated as a committee for a year before they ever tried to talk to their peers. They read the literature together. It was essentially a seminar about the literature. And then they developed a workshop, which I'll tell you more about. And this workshop, we learned it was helpful to do it in a large setting where people don't routinely meet together, so with sort of strangers, because that tended to minimize the dynamics that happen where everybody says what they always say in meetings. So instead of that, you have a greater opportunity for openness. Somebody who came to study us, legal scholar who was interested in this change model, said the STRIDE committee members became what she called organizational catalysts. By working on this problem as a group, developing a sense of expertise, they became people who were also very effective in changing their own department. So they felt much more empowered to talk about these issues, to bring the literature to bear. They knew more than their colleagues about this literature. So one, you know, really low-level insight we had was that increasing the expertise in understanding what the problem is, why it is difficult to hire diverse faculty, helps with the problem, empowering people with knowledge. So since education is something we all have, really is an uncontroversial goal, was helpful. The second thing is they had to learn how to address faculty's concern that to think about diversity is inevitably to lower concern with excellence. So I know this is especially important in the perimeter environment, but Michigan people think it's really important in the University of Michigan environment too. So this is critical for thinking about this problem. It is critical to become convinced, that enough people become convinced, that to think about diversity is not only not to compromise excellence, but is actually to increase excellence. That diversity enhances excellence. And if you don't really believe that, it's hard to move on this issue. So the STRIDE committee members do believe that, and they believe it because they've looked at the literature on it. They offer their colleagues conceptual tools. So they tell them about the literature and these ideas, critical mass, schemas, the associations we have of certain qualities with gender. Men are generally thought by most people to be competent, instrumental, leaderly. Women are thought to be nice, caring, concerned. Those schemas are positive for both, but they're different. And if you're looking for a physicist, you may not care if they're nice or caring. So you're going to be looking for somebody who's competent, more than competent, who's brilliant. And so the probability is that everyone, male and female, and of all races, has a bias towards certain kinds of people as more likely, more promising. And whenever critical mass is low, that is the base rate existence of a category, like women physicists, is low, then that makes their gender highly salient. So male physicist gender is not especially salient. You can't really distinguish a physicist by saying he's a guy. You can by saying she's a woman. So that tends to make us over-attend to someone's gender. And this is true of race as well. So in general, low base rate is a problem when it makes that characteristic that is irrelevant to evaluation too salient. Now, in any given judgment, it's likely that this bias, this evaluation bias, operates only a little bit. But over the course of a career, it tends to accumulate, like interest. So that accumulation of advantage for one group and disadvantage for other groups has a consequence that at the end of careers, or in the late period of careers, there's a much bigger disparity. So for example, salary disparity, which has been demonstrated to exist at senior levels, tends not to be very great when people are at entry level. So repeatedly we hear, okay, that's over, this generation isn't going to have a problem. But in fact, what we see is it's really a cohort effect. Over time, the salary disparity actually does occur. So we do think that there is this accumulation of disadvantage happening for certain groups with respect to salary or recognition or accomplishments of various sorts. Grant, you may have heard about the study in the United States of grant decision making, where African Americans are very disadvantaged in receiving grants, and they're after controlling for many variables. So it's pretty clear race is the disadvantaging feature. So then the STRIDE committee reviews lots of empirical evidence, lots of studies of various kinds, and then the sort of most exciting part of the workshop is that they tie directly those findings to solutions. Given what we know about evaluation bias, how can we actually produce less biased evaluations? And there are procedures that they are in a position to recommend, and most of the schools on campus now require search committee members to participate in these workshops every 3 years if they want to be permitted to serve on a search committee. It's seen as a qualification. So the committee has also formulated a kind of model that helps put together these concepts into a model that accounts for why our institutions keep reproducing themselves and don't become more diverse. So if you start with schemas and either solo status, just a single exemplar of a group, or lack of critical mass, those two things are conditions that produce evaluation bias. And that leads performance to be underestimated in some and overestimated in others. That in turn accumulates over time, leads to a lowered success rate for the group that's being underestimated, which in turn feeds the schemas and the lack of critical mass. So without aggressive action, the system reproduces itself. understanding that has been a really important insight on our campus. And now 50 to 60% of the faculty campus-wide have been to a STRIDE workshop. And just the shared knowledge that actually you do have to do things to try to intervene in this system, or it will reproduce itself unfairly, has made a big difference. So it's changed the way people think about hiring. We also use this, by the way, as a model for thinking about graduate admissions and other related processes. Okay, what about the climate? We use, sometimes people think this sounds pretty wacky, but it's turned out to be very successful. We use a campus theater group that develops sketches based on the social science literature and on talking to faculty that put in front of groups of faculty kind of issues that are hard to talk about when people feel a little bit exposed or like they don't want to, whether they're on the receiving end or the delivering end of bad behavior, they don't want to talk about it with their colleagues. So making it visible in a kind of neutral setting makes it possible to talk about why are faculty meetings pointless and unproductive when certain dynamics happen, or why are mentoring interactions so destructive to junior faculty when senior faculty are so well-intentioned and don't mean to have a negative effect? Or why are tenure evaluations not solely focused on the criteria and qualifications of the person? Why do they get distracted by irrelevant issues? And then the one that we've been doing most recently is one on navigating department politics. What can you as an individual faculty member do when something's going wrong in a faculty context? What is your potential to interrupt problematic interactions? So these sketches are things we use in a bunch of ways, in intentional ways. I mentioned that they're based on research findings and they illustrate what we know, that tokens get perceived in terms of stereotypes, that it, by token I simply mean the solo representative of a group. They get seen in terms of the stereotype of that group, and they get perceived inaccurately because of that. That the leadership's framing of an issue at the beginning of a meeting is critical to what then happens in the meeting. That women get interrupted much more than men. Not all women, not all men, but on average, women get interrupted more than men. Women listen more than men. And who has power and influence is not evenly distributed by gender or race. And then the implications of those dynamics for outcomes. What happens, and also who can change what happens. Okay, shifting to mentoring. So I'm really just trying to review a lot of things we've done, and I'm hoping that you'll tell me which of these you might want to hear more about or don't want to hear anything about. So we've done a lot of things about mentoring. Mentoring is a tricky process. It's difficult because inherently senior faculty are delivering mentoring, and it is inevitable that they will be making decisions about people's work. So the fact that they are both evaluators and mentors is complicated and has to be openly part of the process. We try very hard to recommend that mentors not be the key evaluators and that evaluators not be the key mentors. Those roles need to be separate, but there needs to be a feedback process. So the mentors know what the evaluations are, and the evaluators have input from mentors about what they think the person is doing. We also recognize that not all senior faculty are good mentors one-on-one with junior faculty, but they may have huge expertise and knowledge about operating in the discipline or grant getting or something that is a crucial aspect of career development. They can offer once a year a workshop on, or once every 2 years, a workshop on something, and that's called zone mentoring. You just mentor in your zone, and you mentor everybody. You're not mentoring a particular person. So all the senior people don't have to be doing the same thing. We also encourage the development of peer mentoring groups by junior faculty, groups of, not that they're going to tell each other what to do, but they're support for each other, and they can often articulate, you know, let's ask so-and-so about whatever it is, some issue that they want to know, collaboration in big teams, or collaboration between theorists and experimentalists. Because this person would be a great advisor on that. Or what about career and family? How do we put those things together? We don't actually see much about people's family lives, and apparently they have them, but how do they do that? How do you balance that? Figuring out who it would be a good source to talk to about that. So one model we've used is having junior faculty be funded to invite somebody to lunch, anybody they want, and pay for it, and all the junior faculty get to be present in that conversation. They don't have to be, but they get to be. We also fund junior faculty in fields where there's actually no one right here who knows a lot about what they do, fund them to go visit somebody else who can be an external mentor. This can be extremely helpful. I can think of a case in our statistics department where we were trying to build up a new area and we hired somebody who there was nobody she could really talk to about her work, have read her papers, and so the chair of the department funded her to get that kind of consultation externally. And then the mentoring has to somehow be accountable within the unit, and so figuring out how we'll make sure that it's happening and that it's happening as well as we want it to is part of the process. We did develop and distribute a handbook. We found that senior faculty often said to us, to our surprise, well, okay, let's say I have this person, take this person out to lunch to talk to them about their career. What do I say? So we script them. We tell them what to say. And we tell the junior people, your senior faculty mentor may not know quite how to have this conversation. So here are the things you need advice about. So scripting both sides, making it transparent, helps. And as I mentioned, we use the CRLT players, our theater group, to offer a sketch about mentoring, which usually causes all of us senior faculty to cringe as we see ourselves in it and realize what effects we're having that we don't mean to be having. And the junior faculty are usually very gratified to hear that, yeah, that wasn't good. We also use the tenure sketch to train, I use that word loosely, to prompt a really good conversation with senior faculty about how to make a tenure review truly fair, how to make it thorough, deep, and fair. And so there's a sketch where a tenure review goes wrong in a variety of ways, perhaps more ways than any one tenure review would. And then the faculty have a discussion in depth about what went wrong and what would have helped, both in terms of the committee's deliberation before they ever were considering the case and while they were considering the case. Again, this has been enormously welcomed by the faculty. They enjoy coming to this evening and having the opportunity to think about it. They feel very proud. They think Michigan does this better than anybody else, and they're proud of that. So it hasn't been resisted or rejected. One thing I thought about this a little bit in advance, because you don't have that many faculty, women faculty, to create a network of them. The same effects that happen in our network might happen if the women in Perimeter had a network all together, the students and the faculty. We found that a lot of women scientists, especially in fields dominated by men, have never really experienced other women as a source of support and intellectual excitement. And just that was really exciting for them. They really felt great about getting to know other women and discovering that some of their experiences as women could be shared, and it wasn't depressing or a whining session, which was their fantasy, but in fact was problem solving, and often they ended up thinking up some great scientific idea too. So that was good for them. We try to encourage the creation of those kind of lasting connections through the network, and lots of them have happened, not just science collaborations, but play groups of kids, and all kinds of things have come out of it. We also use the network very deliberately to raise issues and to get feedback from women scientists about what's going on, what their concerns are, and the advanced staff is available to them to deal with, give them advice about how to pursue an issue or to just troubleshoot some specific problem. So I don't think our structure would fit Perimeter, but I think that this is worth thinking about. It's made an enormous difference in the climate for women in STEM at Michigan. We also worry about the climate within each school and within each department. In one of our bigger schools, the dean actually meets every year with the women scientists as a constituency to ask, what do I need to know that I don't know about your life as women scientists? And that's been a huge, had a huge impact, and he meets as well with these other groups, figuring out what are common problems to all of these groups and what are particular problems to a particular group is very, very valuable to him, but it also means issues reach him before their crises. So that kind of feedback, that kind of structured conversation may be something that would be helpful. We also look at data every year. We look at ourselves and talk about it. I'll give you an example. We had a department, we give data back about the race and gender diversity of our every group within the university, every department, and one department got the feedback that they had not actually graduated a female student in 10 years, PhD student. So they were first totally certain that we had the data wrong, because of course they could think of all the women they had admitted. But in fact, every one of those women had left. And they had never collectively noticed that, because of course every woman was a student of a particular faculty member, and they didn't really notice that all the women had left. This produced a crisis, but it was a productive crisis. And if you don't look at the data, you don't know that that kind of attrition is happening. So we put data in front of every department, whether they use it or not is a question. I mean, some do, some don't. But I think that kind of process of reflecting on what's happened and happening can produce very productive growth. Very important to engage leadership. I don't think I need to talk about that. We looked at every single policy in the university. I don't know if Perimeter has enough, you know, sort of weighty history of policies that were generated by men for men, but it might have some. And committees had the job of reviewing every policy about faculty to figure out if there were policies that were really problematic from the perspective of a woman science faculty member. We found 55 that needed to be reformed. And it took 10 years to enact all of the reforms, but we did. Obviously, a few of those 55 were never fixed, but most were. And these included things like looking at the data, recruitment-related policies, family-friendly policies that were made actually family-friendly. And the last one, which was the toughest one, was making our tenure clock more flexible in both directions, that you could both go up faster or slower without a shift in the criteria. And this forced departments to have to name the criteria enough to be able to decide that they could apply the criteria without using time as a dimension. So that's a complicated process. We can talk about it if you want to, but it's been successful. Okay, in 2007, the NSF funding ended. I guess I didn't stress that. We had a grant from NSF to do this. It was $5 million to change the institution, transform it. And in 2007, they would not do re-grants, so we had to either stop doing business or get internally funded. And the university committed to us continuing as long as we would broaden the focus to all fields, and that's not pertinent to you, but it's very relevant to us, and maintain the focus on women, but add other underrepresented groups, which we were very happy to do since we actually weren't comfortable only focusing on women. And they wanted us to develop more programs on the same budget. So bigger mission, more programs, same budget. But it was a big budget. The one thing about science and engineering focus that I do want to mention, we learned that scientists felt stigmatized by the idea that all the other fields had taken care of diversity and somehow science was the problem. Opening it up to all fields actually made it very evident that there's variability in every area of knowledge, and there are humanities fields, social science fields, professional fields that are in no way diverse, that are just as male-dominated as the most male-dominated science field. So that actually was a big help to us. So broadening our mission, I think, was a positive thing, especially in that way. We now do systematic climate assessments as part of the external reviews of every department and school and college. It's because it's now normalized as a regular part of life that you look at the climate, departments really pay attention to them and use them. It's put them on the same plane with how's the scholarly mission going, how's the educational mission going, and what's the climate like. So those three things all matter. And external reviewers get all the reports on all those things. So the discussion is much more serious about climate, and people understand more what that is and why it matters. So the advanced program actually carries these climate studies out. We work with department leadership to design them so they're relevant to what's going on in the department. We assess everybody, the staff, the students, and the faculty. And when we can, we provide, which now we usually can, provide comparative data. How does your department look compared to other physical science departments or other standalone institutes or other humanities departments? Because we've now got a cumulative history of doing lots of these, we're able to help people see, yeah, that doesn't look so good, but nobody looks good on that. Or you look pretty good on that, but not as good as your peers. So it's very important for there to be follow-up discussion of what to do. Many chairs aren't sure what to do with the data, so to help them think about it. So we do that as well. And it's really important when a group is very outnumbered that the image, the picture for them often looks very rosy in the eyes of the majority. So we try to help departments see that and understand why that happens. So if you ask men, what's the climate like for women? On the whole, they think it's pretty good. And if you ask white people what they think the climate is like for people of color, they think it's pretty good. Domestics, about international, same thing. So if you don't have a lot of people to enable you to do real comparative data by those groups, it can be challenging to surface what the issues are. And sometimes a survey is not the best way to do that. Sometimes interviews are a better approach. Okay. Out of the climate studies, we built a program that's called Faculty Leading Change, which has been very effective. Departments can say, okay, we don't have a good mentoring system, or we don't have a good system of prelims for our doctoral students. Whatever they want to fix, they come to a series of workshops, and they're offered coaching about how to make change. Faculty generally assume that making change is a rational process that involves identifying the best idea, which I usually have. I announce it to you, and you agree with me. If that doesn't happen, they then take their marbles and go home. So that's the end of the process. You have voted me down. Sorry, you voted me down, so I'm just going to go home. That's actually a pretty bad model for organizational change. And it turns out that people know a lot about how to make organizational change. So we bring those kind of experts in to talk with faculty about, okay, that's your goal. You want to fix the prelims. Let's talk about how you're going to do that. What are the obstacles? And so they are taken by the hand through a process of thinking through how to make the change and then successfully making it over the course of a year. It turns out that this has produced dramatic changes in evaluation processes, mentoring processes, all kinds of things in different departments where people decided what they wanted to work on and worked on it. As it says here, it does include some didactic presentations and some observation of sketches that are used as a prompt for discussion, but then there's lots of project work with the team, applying concepts and working through their change idea. I would say the number of departments that actually make changes, as opposed to talking about making changes, has dramatically increased in the presence of this program, which we've been doing for about 7 years. Okay, then we had a third evaluation of ADVANCE and whether we should be re-upped. Michigan tends to like five-year reviews of everything, so in July 2011, we were renewed again for five more years. And here we committed to really focusing on department level change, where most people's day-to-day life happens, and on maintaining the momentum of leadership development. So we launched these two new programs. We developed a system of having launch committees for junior faculty in their first year. So these are available to all junior faculty when in STEM fields. And the committee, its goal is to start from the date of the person accepting our offer and work with them for a year, at the end of which they are thought to be launched. So their focus is on the transition. What does it mean to go from being a postdoc or a graduate student to a faculty member? What does it mean to be in charge of driving your research program? How do you get that off the ground quickly? Because the tenure process is short, and you need to hit the ground running. So five people serve on this committee: the candidate themselves, the department chair, a senior faculty aligned with their research inside the department and outside the department, and an advanced faculty member trained to be a convener who raises the issues, helps keep the conversation going. They meet monthly, and every time I ever talk about this, people say, well, our faculty would never cooperate in this because it's too intense. It turns out our senior faculty would way prefer to participate in this than in mentoring, which they consider different, diffuse, open-ended, permanent. And they love that this is a one-year, time-limited process, and the goals are clear. They also love that they have an opportunity to really work with somebody whose research they generally find very exciting. So this has been the least difficult to launch, excuse my pun, program we've ever launched. We've had no negative outcomes or pushback, except we did learn that we had to explicitly create a connection between the launch process and the mentoring. A lot of the junior people said, well, when the launch committee ends, will I just fall off a cliff? So it became clear they didn't feel the mentoring structure in the department was going to be there for them. So we had to really build a connection that was very explicit. The second thing we have been running is a program at the transition to associate and the transition to full. These programs encourage faculty to really reflect on themselves and think about how at these sort of big moments, marker moments in their career, they might want to deploy themselves differently. They get a lot of attention. They get opportunity to participate in a program with each other, which they enjoy. And the transition to fulls get a year of individual coaching once a month. I mean, they're not being coached every minute. that they can use to help them work on whatever it is whatever goal they have. I want to become a leader in my discipline, disciplinary organization. I'm not very good at that. I don't really understand how to do that, but I think I want to do it. I want to shape the direction they're going in. So that's the kind of coaching that they're getting. Okay, I want to end by talking about some data. In 2001, we assessed campus-wide climate among all faculty, and then we repeated that study in 2006 and 2012. And we looked especially at gender and race, and these are the issues that we measured, or the topics that we had measures of in all three times. In 2001, we had no idea, is our climate like really terrible, pretty good, or great? And the data don't really tell you that. It's a benchmark. Here's what your climate looks like. And in 2006, we actually saw very little change in the climate. So the measures that changed were unwanted sexual attention reported by women and overall feelings of felt surveillance by minorities. This is minority faculty. So felt surveillance is things like, I feel like people are watching to see me fail. Or I feel like I really am scrutinized more than other people in my department. So those are good things to have go down, but it wasn't a lot. In contrast, and I was, by the way, very discouraged by that. It felt to me like we'd worked for 5 years and nothing much had happened. In 2012, we had change in all groups. All groups improved on almost all indicators. The one group that sometimes didn't was men of color, who tended to actually report high levels of satisfaction, higher levels of satisfaction than we would have predicted. But the other three groups all improved statistically significantly on every measure. So they were on all these things, including things that we weren't really directly trying to influence, like overhearing disparaging remarks about women or racial ethnic minorities. So we never did a program on that. We didn't try to stop people from saying things other people would overhear. But apparently the overall discourse was better, and people were not hearing those things. So that's the good news, and certainly we trumpeted our good news. The bad news was that there was no change in the relative pattern of scores. So white men are the happiest, men of color are next, white women are next, and women of color are at the bottom. That pattern is exactly the same all three times. And that's not what we wanted. We hope to see convergence. The good part of the bad news is that in the beginning of our program, we certainly heard from some white men, if you pay all that attention to women and minorities, what's going to happen to men, white men? Well, turns out they're going to be happier. So it turned out that this was an argument that was unassailable. We thought it would be true that the climate for everyone would be better, but it turned out that it is better. So the white men are now much less anxious about what the consequences of diversity are for them. So that's a good thing. Then the last thing I want to talk about is we took the 20 departments that are in STEM fields that had been the most targeted by us for the longest period of time, so 12 years. And we interviewed 59 faculty from those 20 departments, about three per department. And we tried to talk to them about what had changed for them and what hadn't changed in the department for those 12 years. So we only interviewed people who'd been there a long time. So it's very much the perspective of senior faculty, including the chair. So one person we interviewed in every case was the chair. The departments did not differ statistically in terms of their representation of women and minorities at the beginning of this process. So then we categorized them into three groups. Departments that changed a lot in terms of the proportion of women, changed some, and changed not at all. So the question we asked is, do those three groups differ in what they report? It could be they differ in what they actually did, and it could be that they differ in how they talk about what they did, or it could be both. It's a little hard to tell what we got, whether it's really differences in what happened or mostly differences in how they talk about what happened. But I want to close by saying how we talk about these issues is totally important. So in the substantial change group, the most surprising finding was that people were most likely to talk about diversity is a very serious problem in our department, and I feel really bad about it. So what kind of problem? It could be the one I mentioned, we haven't graduated a woman in 10 years, or it could be we don't have any women on the faculty, or it could be there was a terrible and embarrassing and upsetting sexual harassment case, somebody got denied tenure, whatever. A wide range of different things were the problem, but they were openly clear that there is a problem, and they thought it was important that the department do something about it. So that is a characteristic of the departments that change. Psychologists know that the most important predictor of whether people change is wanting to. So I shouldn't have been surprised, but I was surprised by this finding. The second finding is also, this one's unsurprising, that strong leadership by the chair mattered. And this strong leadership needed to be not just that the chair cared about diversity, because all of them say they do, all of them, but that the chair was able to articulate how diversity was going to improve the department and how it was an avenue or would provide a pathway to even greater excellence. So the chair had to be in command of understanding the value of diversity in the student body as well as in the faculty. In the discussions, people from these kinds of departments talked about favorable features of the department context. So I'm not sure there were more favorable features, but they focused on them. So they talked about how so-and-so got promoted and he really cares about this, so he's been working hard on it. Or so-and-so retired and he was really a problem on this, and that was helpful. So generational turnover was certainly one of the things they talked about, but there were many other things. We hired so-and-so and that person's great, everybody loves her, she thinks she's a brilliant scientist, and that's really turned people around. Whatever, or the field is graduating more women, or I went to a conference and saw this amazing woman and we made an offer to her and she accepted it. So they focused on positive features. And they reported a very high level of proactivity. They went to conferences with diversity on their mind, they identified talented scholars, they brought them to campus, they wooed them, they pursued collaborations with them, they made this a priority in their actions. In the Little or No Change group, the rhetoric was entirely negative. So they would talk about external factors that preclude change, the pipeline's empty, there's nobody there, we can't really attract them, everybody's competing for the same two people. Jordy is telling you, okay, there are at least two there. And you're not succeeding in competing for this. But there's this kind of self-excusing narrative that it's impossible, it can't be done, we're doing everything we can. A strong emphasis on unfavorable features of the department context, like we have this, everybody cares about diversity in our department, but there's this group that thinks it will compromise excellence and they really hold the cards, they're in our way. Or all of them say, as I said, we care about diversity, but we care about something else more, like excellence or the needs of a subfield. So diversity is rankable with excellence rather than being seen as compatible with excellence. So it's not surprising there was little change in these departments once we heard how they talk about the problem. You wouldn't expect much change from a group of people who see the problem this way. The moderate change group had some of both kinds of themes. They were strikingly optimistic and mentioned favorable things. They also were proactive from the top group, but they tended not to recognize any past problem. They tended to be quite satisfied with themselves, and they tended not to have strong leadership on diversity. So we're suspecting that those two features are really critical to significant or more rapid change. So I've said this, but this is just kind of the summary. We think that this kind of notion that searching for diversity is something you can get expert at and be good at and succeed at, that kind of optimistic self-narrative is really helpful to a department or to an institute, and that it helps sustain commitment and effort over time. If you really think the problem's intractable, it's hard to motivate yourself to do anything about it. So I think the narrative itself has power in this case. Okay, so change is slow. I was very discouraged at 5 years. I thought I should stop doing the project. I was talked into staying, but I really thought, you know, this is crazy. For you, it feels like maybe it would be a lot faster in a smaller institution. I was trying to, you know, turn around a battleship. That's bigger. Organizational climate is tricky. It's made up of so many interactions, so many different processes, and they're all influencing each other. So it is complicated no matter what size a unit is. But one of the reasons we ended up focusing on departments is that they were more, it's a more manageable size to intervene in. And I think that too is optimistic for Perimeter. Even though Perimeter is bigger than a department typically, it's still a size that's manageable to intervene in. Leadership matters, it matters everywhere. But one of the things we learned was that it was really important for us to help senior faculty over the idea that they can't make anything happen. They had to become part of the solution, and the best way for them to become part of the solution was to help them see when that kind of bad thing goes on in your department or your situation with a mentee, you can do better. It is possible to fix that, and it's not that hard. So helping people empower themselves was a big part of the process. So these are our, you know, NSF calls them bullet points. These are like what we can tell NSF is the good news. So we did consistently greatly increase the rate at which we hire women faculty in STEM fields from 13% to a very stable 32% over that long period. We've gone from having one woman in a leadership role, STEM faculty member in a leadership role, to 27. I mentioned the climate improvement. We've really made major changes in all these practices, recruitment, evaluation, mentoring, et cetera. We give chairs more training. I didn't talk about that, but chairs become chairs not because they went to chair school. So we help them with some of the skills they don't come to that job with. Family-friendly policies, really making data the basis of our changes, and learning that change is its own kind of engine for more change, and that changes improve things for everybody. That all helped. So that's everything I have to say. I'm eager to hear your questions or comments or ideas about how things might work here differently. So thank you.
So who wants to start off the questions? Okay, I guess that means me. You said a number of times that it's important to have a widespread view that excellence and diversity, I was going to say compatible, but maybe that diversity enhances excellence,
exactly.
Something like that. So can you articulate why that is?
Yes. And it's really important that people be in a position to do that, be able to articulate it because they actually have read literature and believe it. So there's a pretty clear literature on the solution of hard problems. Some of you may know Scott Page's work on this issue. The solution of very difficult problems is always enhanced by people having a very diverse intellectual toolkit, by having a group of people who are more different than the same. If you put those two groups, a group that's very similar and a group that's very diverse intellectually, on the same problem, this group will come up with better solutions and faster, usually faster, sometimes slower. I'll talk about that in a second. It's also true that diversity of intellectual outlook is related to demographic features. So it is the case that our life history, the experiences we accumulate across a life, are different depending on the kind of place we started and the kind of body we experience the world in. That's not always obvious in terms of an intellectual toolkit, but it is obvious in terms of the kind of perspective that people can bring on a problem. Scientists are always more uncertain about why that should be true, but it is demonstrably true in the research that the more diverse demographically a group is, as long as that diversity is associated with perspective, different perspectives and toolkits, the more creative the solutions. There is also a literature, a completely separate literature, that shows that when you have diverse groups of people, they are far more likely to come up with fair outcomes, fair processes and fair outcomes. Not because the diverse people, the women and minorities, are fairer than the non-diverse people, but because the conversation's different. When the conversation is only held among a homogeneous group, lots of assumptions are made, lots of things are taken for granted, and when you're in a diverse group, you have to articulate your assumptions more, you have to spell out what you're thinking more, and that process leads to a more successful deliberation that's fairer and takes more account of the evidence. So both creativity and fairness have been demonstrated to be enhanced by diversity, and the converse is also true, that they are, homogeneity is a negative factor in both creativity and fairness. So those are pretty powerful arguments. Now, they don't tell you that an individual who isn't like you is a better person to hire than an individual who is like you. So they don't get you to that place. They get you to the place of thinking, wow, it would be better if I had a diverse community of people to talk to about these issues. There are problems with diversity. It is also true that conflict arises more with diversity than under conditions of homogeneity. So you do actually have to have better processes for diversity to work positively. But there's also evidence that that can be done. And the last thing that I wanted to bring up, about this is that we are very poor judges of people who do not fit our pre-existing schemas. So we are very likely to underestimate talent in packages that are unexpected, bodies that are unexpected, and to overestimate it in bodies that are expected. So those two forms of bias mean that we are actually not choosing the best person when we think we are. So that concern, that awareness, that kind of belief, it makes clear we're not actually choosing the most excellent person. And so I'll stop this very long answer with one example. We had a department that had two positions, and they brought in 10 candidates for the two positions they wanted to bring in. They had a short list after reviewing their pool. They had a short list of 10. The short list of 10 had only white and Asian men on it. So the dean of that school said, well, I see your pool had a pretty significant representation of underrepresented minorities and white women, so I think your list, you should reconsider. Just go back and reconsider your pool. They went back and reconsidered their pool. Obviously, they felt pressure. That's for sure. So they changed their list. Now they had 6 white and Asian men. They had 3 men who of color, I think, and 1 white woman. Maybe they had women and men of color. They had 3 people of color and 1 white woman. The people they ended up hiring after the interviews, and of course, by then, they had much more data and were much more certain, were the white woman and a minority man. So that was a very powerful lesson to that department. That department went from being resistant and reluctant to this issue to realizing, wow, we totally miss these people. They were in our pool, they did not make it through our filter, and they were the ones we wanted to hire. So that department is gangbusters working on diversity because they believe, okay, we have to think about how we judge talent differently. Sorry for being that long. I promise I'll do that again.
Thanks, Abby. It was a great talk. You just mentioned widening the pool, so you go back to the pool, but were there very, very specific different criteria used in hiring?
No. So the point was go back and think about whether you got the best people out of the pool. Just look at your pool again. That was the only direction. And we have found that as long as the search committee specifies criteria up front in enough detail that they can really be held to the criteria and not to kind of halo judgments, that does lead them to diverse outcomes. By diverse, I do not mean every time a woman or minority is the preference. 32% of the time, women are. Not every time. Not even half the time. But 32%. So it's a lot higher than it used to be. And so we're not at all, we do not believe, and legally we could not believe, but we do not believe, that it's a favor to hire women and minorities who people are less excited about. That's not good. That's not my message at all. You don't have to change the criteria. You have to change how you look at the evidence. That's the critical thing. Sometimes the evidence is different in groups that have had fewer opportunities to have leadership chances, to give keynote addresses. We all know that every association is realizing, oh my God, we haven't had a woman in 5 years, whatever. So there are lots of opportunities that come more to white men or Asian men in some fields than they come to other groups. And so thinking about what the evidence is, looking at the work, honestly, the closer the reading of the work, the more the women and minorities are likely to rise. It's not about who their mentor was. It's not about whether they were at the most prestigious institution. Very often, women and minorities have not been those people. They've been brilliant in a second-tier institution. So it's really widening your openness to where talent might be. It might not be in all the usual places.
But your search committee would have been given some guidance as far as what things to search for?
Well, they weren't given specific guidance after the fact, when they were asked to go back and look at the pool. They were trained by going to the STRIDE meeting. They got the workshop, workbook, handbook. They know what the ideas are about criteria. But obviously they hadn't done it very well if they ended up with a list that didn't have their top choices in the end.
Thank you.
Is there any evidence that if you stripped out sort of identifying features from CVs, that that would help search committees choose people more based on their qualifications as opposed to maybe excluding people because of their gender or other conditions?
Right. Great question. It is, there's tons of evidence that when you strip, so if you give people resumes, the identical resume, I give half of you a resume labeled John, and I give the other half of you a resume labeled Jane. Jane will be much less exciting than John. There's definite evidence on that, lots of it. And you know, recently it was repeated with scientists' choices of a lab manager. This has been done to death. So yes, that should work. However, when you think about applying that to job candidates, the one study I know of where they tried to do that, what people did was spend all their energy on figuring out the gender of the person. So, right or wrong, they decided who was male and who was female. So that isn't really helpful. So it turns out that humans are astonishingly oriented to gender. And you know, those of you who've ever seen a baby know everyone wants to know, is it a boy or a girl? It doesn't actually make much difference, right, to what you're going to do next. But everybody wants to know. So it's a fact we orient to. And not having it, having it removed, doesn't seem to help in this sense. So I'm not sure that that would help. But I think it does help. We know it helps to focus people away from gender and toward the criteria. And you know, I talk a lot to committees about empower yourselves to call each other on, what do you mean she doesn't have any, isn't likely to be good in teaching the intro course. What's your evidence for that? The three times she taught it, she got great ratings. So I don't understand what evidence you're using. So people are often not using evidence. They're imagining something. And if challenged on evidence, scientists usually are willing to say, oh, yeah, that's a point.
So the figures you showed at the end were quite dramatic improvements, but you didn't show us comparison with other universities.
No.
It'd be nice if we could believe that this was just part of a trend that was everywhere.
Secular trend.
Yes. So can you say something about
that? Yeah. So I don't actually think it's tactful or wise for me to make any pointed comparisons, and that's what one would have to do, because you'd have to compare Michigan's rates to somebody, and that would mean comparing it to likes. So I'm not going to do that. But I will say there is a secular trend of a very small level in women doing better at R1, first-tier universities in the United States. It's nowhere near the level of ours. So I do believe that we would be better now than we were in 2001, but I don't believe we'd be this much better without this level of activity. When I say believe, I mean based on that data, the evidence on secular trend. There's not a lot of secular trend, actually. It's a little.
You talked about gender, race, national origin, and so on. One thing you didn't talk about was class, for example. Uh-huh. Is there studies on that, or do you have an idea on that? Do you think it's important that that be?
I think it's hugely important and very understudied. So there's not a lot of data. Most graduate schools are now beginning to offer some kind of programming around, if you're a first generation, even graduate student, never mind you were first generation to go to college and now you're in graduate school. But among faculty, social class background is often very invisible. The academic socialization to the discipline and to the academy tends to strip quite a bit of class marker away. Americans or U.S. people are particularly bad at thinking and talking about class. So I think it's a very important subject, and I think I'm thrilled that graduate students are getting more attention on this issue, but there's very little work. What there is the some work on the feelings of working class origin people in the academy, which are on the whole negative. Their feelings are similar to the feelings of white women and people of color, that they feel like there are lots of cues that they don't belong, lots of dismissiveness or assumptions about who they are that are very disturbing. So I think it's an important issue. It's just there's not a lot of data.
Thanks.
I know there's a hand that's been up in the back.
Okay, so
probably
I can
couldn't see it. Oh. Keeping you running.
So thanks for a very nice talk. You mentioned a couple of times the value of having explicit criteria, both for searches and for promotion evaluations. Could you give some examples of good criteria that don't sort of, I mean, I think there's lots of reasons that people avoid criteria that are too explicit. For example, I'll let you answer the question now.
Well, okay, so I'll fantasize what you were gonna say, which is, you know, three articles in a particular journal is proof that they are good enough, as opposed to a publication history that suggests they will publish. Those are, the former is not a good idea. It's much too prescriptive, and the latter is better. So by explicit, I also mean it's not just about the record of, you know, there's some things everybody's using all the time for hiring faculty. Publication, grant getting, recognition in disciplinary settings. Those are pretty standard things. So there are other criteria. Is the work exciting? Is the work original? Is it creative? That cannot be read off where it was published. It can only be established by discussion among people who can read it and think about it. So that's the kind of explicit criteria I'm talking about. Criteria that get at the actual quality of the work, as opposed to criteria that are kind of anybody, even a non-physicist, could count how many publications in which journals, right? That's not the judgment you want. And then the other point is, there are criteria that are important for certain kinds of positions and that often are not on the table, and they need to be put on the table by being explicit. So one might be interest or openness to interdisciplinary collaboration. That might not be relevant here, I don't know, but it is at Michigan. It's an important criterion for it, some positions, that people are interested in dialogue and exchange and eventually collaboration with other disciplines. Another criterion that, and not everybody's good at that, being a star in your subfield might have nothing to do with being good at collaborating interdisciplinarily. It might be negatively correlated with it. A second possibility is that you care what kind of a mentor, teacher, fellow colleague this person is. And most academics take that off the table. You know, this guy's really obnoxious, but he's brilliant, so we'll hire him. We have departments that have made up their minds. They're not going to do that. And they are rising in the rankings. They are thriving, including a criterion about what kind of human being is this. So, you know, there's a book in the corporate sector called The No Asshole Rule, and that the argument of that book is that it costs corporations massively when they select someone who's a jerk but outstanding, because the costs that come associated with that person's obnoxiousness are so high. It's worth it for a department or an institute to think about that. Do we want that to be a criterion? If you do, you have to take it seriously then. So that's been a productive conversation at Michigan. It's not the case that everybody's come to the same conclusion, but everybody's thinking about it, because the cost to the climate of somebody who's going to be very difficult, it's large. And you have to decide, are we willing to pay that cost or not? If you are, that's okay, but you've then decided it's okay with you that this person's that way. Of course, sometimes you can't tell.
Another question?
Did you have one? Okay.
Okay, let's thank Abby again. Oh, wait, sorry. Okay. Thank Abby again.
Thank you.
So if you did have another question, we have a high tea out in the bistro, I guess now, and presumably Abby will be able to talk to people there. Next week we have, I believe, Mark Van Ramstonk.